a warning?
There ain't nothing to worry about.
I worried that you work in an office, have children, celebrate wedding anniversaries. The world of heterosexual is a sick and boring life.
The Black Mamba can deliver as much as 100 to 400 milligrams of venom from a single bite. Now, in these last agonizing minutes of life you have left, let me answer that question you asked earlier more thoroughly. Right at this moment, the biggest R I feel is regret. Regret that maybe the greatest warrior I have ever met her end at the hands of a bushwhacking, scrub, elky piece of shit like you. That woman deserved better.
Welcome back to the show, everyone.
Welcome back to the show.
Goodness gracious, so dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I'm ready for this. This is a two-parter.
This is a two-parter on the podcast.
Yeah, we rarely do two-parters, but we're back for part two. We'll do a quick recap. No, we don't have to do a recap. But listeners, I hope you guys are ready. My name is Pete.
And I'm Scott, and these are the movies that made us gay. Nicholas Romero, welcome back to the show. Last on for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and you joined us today for Kill Bill Volume 2, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, which premiered at the Cinerama Dome April 8th, 2004, and then went on to its United States release April 16th, 2004, 20 years ago this week of the recording. How do you like that?
Nicholas, welcome back to the show.
Thank you guys for having me back for the third time.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, that's wild. This was, what did we say, 20 years?
20 years ago, so this is a spring release. Kill Bill Volume 1 was October. I mentioned on our last recording of Volume 1 that I always think of these movies kind of encapsulating my senior year of high school.
Oh,
so
sure.
It was released the fall of my senior year of high school, and then the spring of my senior year of high school. And I was reading, and I forgot that this movie was originally dated for February, and then they pushed it back to kind of tie into the DVD release of Volume 1.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. That's fun. So I know because this is, we're wrapping up our Kill Bill 2-week, special. And I know in honor of that, you've got a leading ladies quiz for us.
I do.
Today. Shall we do that first or shall we do our memories of the movie?
Let's
first?
Do the Uma Thurman quiz first.
Okay. Nicholas, are you ready for an Uma Thurman quiz?
He warned me, and I did not have time
I did.
To prepare.
I texted you earlier just to kind of prep you.
All right,
so we
all
tend
right.
to do the leading ladies quiz when we get usually about 5 movies covered on the show. And Uma Thurman, an actress who both Pete and I love, I don't know about you, Nicholas, but definitely someone that we grew up on. And I talk about on the show just kind of having this infatuation with Uma Thurman from a very young age.
Uh-huh.
I think it was just kind of seeing those images of the box art for Pulp Fiction, that it was not a movie that I watched young. I didn't get to that movie until I was probably in junior high, but I was just obsessed with this beautiful raven-haired beauty with this bob on the box art. And I later, I had a poster in my room of Uma Thurman.
And you said, that's a wig?
That's a wig.
Mm-hmm. Not normally a raven-haired beauty. Typically, a blonde bombshell.
Iconically blonde, which is kind of interesting that they put her in that black wig. But yeah, I mean, Uma Thurman, one of my early beards. I mean, I think that early internet passwords of mine on Hotmail were any variation of Uma Thurman.
Oh, mama.
Uma Thurman fan 101.
Oh, mama. I love it.
I was that kid. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, all of the Uma Thurman movies that we have talked about on the show, episode 50, Batman and Robin, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, Gattaca, and now Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Okay, work. It's a lot of Uma movies.
A lot of Uma movies that we've talked about. You know, we've been kind of going through a Daryl Hannah phase on the podcast.
This is true.
I was thinking about doing a supersized quiz, but then I'm going to put it off because we might be doing a Daryl Hannah movie later this year.
Oh, word.
So
okay.
We're going to save that till later in the year.
All right.
But okay.
You got off easy, Nick. No Daryl Hannah for you.
Yeah, no double feature.
All right, let's jump right in.
This one, I think we're starting out pretty easy. Okay. Can you both tag team her most known for on IMDb? When you search Uma Thurman in the Internet Movie Database, the movies that come up for most known for.
Okay, the top four.
Pulp Fiction, of course.
Pulp Fiction
is there.
All right, good to go. I'm going to say Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Batman and Robin?
Batman and Robin's there.
Oh,
yep.
Work. Okay. And then the last one.
Something newer or older?
Don't think too hard on it.
Don't think too hard. Is it Kill Bill Volume 2?
It's Kill Bill Volume
2. Oh, crying out loud. That's too easy.
It's a little too easy. I think that I'm surprised that something like Gattaca doesn't sneak in there. But yeah. I mean, it makes sense just because like all of these movies are so iconic. I mean, her Poison Ivy. I am a huge fan of The Truth About Cats and Dogs and Gattaca, but I'm not really surprised it does not come up.
So, yeah. I mean, I
it
think
makes sense if, that it's those.
If there
movies.
Was any justice in this world, Red, White, and Royal Blue would be on her most known for.
I mean, give it a couple years, it could surface up there with like the algorithm. You never know.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Her accent in that movie was fantastic.
My God, so great.
Like
so quotable. Yeah.
Okay, so of all the movies that we've covered on the show, what is the highest? So all of the movies that we've had episodes for, what do you think is the highest grossing movie?
Made the most money? Yeah.
It is actually Pulp Fiction.
Oh.
Which I believe Pulp Fiction and Batman and Robin's grosses were very close.
Okay.
Yep. They were very close. I want to say that it's less than $1 million. Like,
oh, wow.
Like the early 100 millions. Yep.
Okay.
All right. So I'm curious if any of you can get this, especially you, Pete. Do you know what her name means?
What does Uma mean?
Her dad is like a professor of Buddhism, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh gosh. I don't know. I don't know. Goddess.
Her full name is Uma Karuna Thurman, where Uma is named after the Hindu goddess of beauty and light, where Karuna means compassion or kindness. Her father, who's a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies, called it, or like he named her after that.
Okay.
And though her name means one in Portuguese and kiss in Polynesian. Very interesting.
Okay. So, but in what is the original language you said it was?
Let's see. I think that it means in Hindu it means beauty and light.
Okay, there you go.
I just realized that I fucked up one of the questions. I said the highest gross of Uma's career that we've covered on the podcast, it was Batman and Robin. I got it confused with my next question.
No!
Which Scott. Is the highest grossing movie of
so
Uma's
he was
career.
Right the first
so
time.
So you were right the first time, Nick. Okay. I just fucked up that question.
Okay.
So Pulp Fiction, which narrowly beat Batman and Robin. So you're right.
Because we haven't done Pulp Fiction on the podcast.
We haven't done Pulp Fiction on the podcast.
Which I'm so surprised by.
No!
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna get to that one for sure. But okay, that makes more sense. So Batman and Robin of the movies that we've done was the highest.
I should have been reading my notes a little closer.
Okay.
I was kind of anticipating the next question.
That's okay. All right.
I mean, the next question is Pulp Fiction themed. We talked a little bit about it on the last episode.
Kathy Griffin.
Not Kathy Griffin, even though she is in Pulp Fiction. Okay. The TV show pilot that Mia Wallace talks about, Fox Force 5.
Yes.
Her character, Raven McCoy, do you know what her weapon of choice was?
Blade. Knives.
It's a knife.
A knife.
And do you remember what her, Nick, do you remember what her other little character beat was that she talks about with Vincent?
I don't actually.
That they would try
I've
to do it in every episode?
Once.
Okay.
I know how dare I.
No, no, it's okay. As long as you've seen it the one time, that's good. That's good to go in my book. Okay, so there was something else that she did.
What would Raven do in every single episode, even though she got to do it once?
The thighs? I don't know.
And it's kind of something in the script that they call back because she doesn't want to tell it to Vincent. She tells a joke.
She tells a joke. That's it.
Mia's character, Raven McCoy, was raised by circus performers. According to the show, is the deadliest woman in the world with a knife. She also knew a zillion old jokes from her grandfather, an old vaudevillian. Yep. And they would try to do a joke.
She says all that in the...
She does. It's when they're in the diner. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
All right.
We got that half right.
I mentioned The Truth About Cats and Dogs. Great episode, listeners, if you want to listen to us talk about that. Do you know what her character name is in The Truth About Cats and Dogs?
Okay.
I'll just take first name. I don't know.
I should know this.
I can't remember what her last name is.
I should know this.
But I'll take first.
And I'm going to say it is Hildegard.
Noelle.
I knew that. Oh, darn it.
All right.
You know I'm bad at those things.
Pete, you're going to appreciate our next question because we just did watch The Abyss. I watched it for the first time. I had never seen it. It was one of Pete's favorite James Cameron movies. But what does Uma Thurman have in common with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Kate Blanchett? What does she have in common with both of them?
Did she play Maid Marian?
She played Maid Marian.
Ooh, I knew that. I got that.
In a movie that nobody remembers, that I only know from, it was attached to our video store's copy of Edward Scissorhands.
Who was Robin Hood for against Uma Thurman?
I can't remember his name.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think he's kind of like a deep pull in British cinema. Oh. I can't remember off the top of my head. Okay. I always remember the Robin Hood trailer was attached to Edward Scissorhands.
Wow.
At our video store. Yep. So I only know it from that.
All right. Work.
So what is her full character name in Batman and Robin? Nick, do you know this?
It should be Pamela Isley.
Pamela Isley. Very good. Yep.
Pamela?
I love all of her scenes in Batman Robin. She's so much fun in that movie. All right.
She really is.
She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Pulp Fiction in 1995. Who did she lose to?
Oh, for fuck.
And I believe this is the actress's second Oscar in this category.
For supporting actress?
For supporting, yep.
In 95?
Both from the same director, if you want a little hint. And Uma has worked with this director.
Oh, Lord. What was happening in 95? The Fugitive?
This is a double supporting actress nomination in the category because Jennifer Tilly also shared the category, and she's in the movie that this actress won for.
Okay, then I know what it is. Is it Diane Wiest in Bullets Over Broadway?
It's Diane Wiest for Bullets Over Broadway.
Damn.
Her second supporting actress Oscar.
Pull from Pete.
Very good.
Damn, I love it.
So,
you guys, you don't have to. Just, you can stop.
Oh, stop it. All right. Well, speaking of the 1995 Academy Awards, Uma is kind of notable in fashion history for changing the game for how you dress at the Oscars because she wore like a high fashion label. Do either of you know who she wore? This is always on lists of like most famous Oscar dresses.
Is it 95?
Yeah.
Her year that she was nominated?
Yep.
Gosh.
What was big in 95?
I can't even remember what she wore.
It wouldn't have been like
Gucci.
Versace?
Yeah.
It is Prada.
Prada.
She showed up in sort of a light lavender dress. And I mean, at that time with going to award shows, I don't think that actresses generally wore like these fancy designers. I think that they just kind of pick something out last minute.
Well, they
and just
definitely
wore it. Yep.
Stylists to the stars was not a thing.
Yeah.
Right. So like Rachel Zoe and like La Roche didn't have jobs.
Are kind of wearing like a big fashion house.
So you would you would style yourself like Kim Basinger and Gina Davis and all these women who would wear these crazy looks kind of went out and looked for it themselves. And so, I guess you had to just go to these houses or just maybe get an offer. But that's interesting. Okay.
All right. Our last question is our last question is who was Uma married to before her relationship with Ethan Hawke? This is kind of an interesting one that people forget that they were a thing and they were married.
When were they married?
1990.
I know.
Only lasted 2 years.
I know the answer.
Who?
Is it Gary Oldman?
It's Gary Oldman.
It's Gary Oldman.
I can never remember if
no
it's Gary.
Kidding.
I can never remember
if
it's...
I'm a winner, baby!
Wow. I was going to say, I can never remember if it was Gary Oldman or John Malkovich, because I think that they could kind of be interchangeable.
Ew, no. Malkovich is gross.
But married to Gary Oldman.
Is Gary Oldman not gross?
very, very old man. In 1990, Gary Oldman was not gross.
In 1990, in the early 90s.
My only reference for him is Dracula.
Dracula. Yeah. There are scenes when he's young Dracula and he's all right.
Oh, wait, wait, wait. True Romance. I got it. Never mind. It's fine.
Scary in that, too. He's pretty scary in that one. But no, I feel like cleaned up early 90s, Gary Oldman was a catch, but still considerably older than Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
He's in like in his 60s now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's
okay,
our work.
That's our Uma quiz.
Yay.
I love her. One of my favorite actresses. Yep.
You love a statuesque, like
a statuesque
blonde
beauty. Yes.
Okay. Work. All right. Well, we should jump right into Kill Bill Volume 2.
So I always knew that we were going to do a Kill Bill episode. It was probably going to be our first time talking about Tarantino, even though we kind of had a side conversation in our Switchblade Sisters episode about Tarantino. Just kind of naturally, you just kind of think of both Quentin and Switchblade Sister both hand in hand now. Mm. Big inspiration for a character in this movie, but I kind of knew that I wanted to do a proper episode for Volume 2 because I think that you just have to view these movies as one. I think that Quentin would probably, if Quentin was a listener of the podcast, but you never know, he could be. I think that he would say that you have to do both.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also feel like, you know, there's the idea that these two movies were originally planned as one big movie, yeah, right? One big story. And it is one big story. But I think movie-wise, film-wise, they're so different tonally that, like, you can fully just be like, well, I'm in the mood to watch Volume 1 today, yeah, whereas you maybe not be in the mood to watch Volume 2 or vice versa, you know, because they're so different, right? I feel like they just have such different vibes that they do kind of stand alone as their own, you know, movies, even though they are this overarching big story. Mm-hmm.
What are our first memories of first watching this? So I talk about that I have not seen any of these movies in the theater. I really hate that, and I need to solve it and just go to one at the New Beverly one of these days. Right. But I would have taken this movie home from the video store, probably early when we first got it, because I worked there. So sure. I watched it at home.
Nicholas, why don't you tell us about your kind of history with, I guess, with both of them and your earliest memories?
I would have seen both of them like back to back with my mom on DVD. We would have owned them. I probably around 2010. There was a point where we were watching a lot of Tarantino movies. She was really like introducing me to him. We watched Kill Bill and True Romance probably within like the same weekend, I would say. So probably around 2010.
Nice. Okay. Okay. And did you feel like an affinity to one more than the other? Did you like them both as like we said, like one big movie, or did you kind of feel like?
I feel like you need, they need to be together. You can watch one and I feel like one's its own thing, but like, I don't think, in my opinion, I don't think two is strong enough to be its own movie. Like I went into two just for this rewatch. Didn't start with one, which I've never done before. If I'm going to watch them, I'm going to watch one, two sequentially.
Right.
I went into it and I was like, okay, this isn't what I remembered in the sense of not too much happens in two. There's a lot more dialogue, a lot less violence. There's three kills.
Oh yeah. I was going to say only three characters die on camera, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
Which I kind of did not really, I guess it didn't really register with me that only three characters die on camera.
And the bride only kills one.
Yeah. Of them. Yeah. And technically, I mean, yeah, she kills one and it wasn't anything brutal.
Right. Right. I mean, it is the culmination of this entire thing, right? That we are building to, you know, it's the title Kill Bill. And so it's like, it's got to happen, but you're right. At the same time, it's not this crazy epic fight that we've seen throughout her entire journey, which I kind of read that originally there was going to be a big fight with Bill, a sword fight on the beach, like under the moonlight, and the two of them using their Hanzo swords and all of that. But it just kind of turned out to be this like picnic table, you know,
backyard fight
conversation. And it really just, it's a quick little turnaround until she gets her, you know, 5-point palm exploding heart, which is pretty cool to see it, but it would have been even more epic at the end of like a big sword fight. But I agree with you tonally there. It is so different.
It would have been interesting to see them cut as one movie. Like,
right.
Is it, I don't know. I think that the thing about Volume 1, which is so much fun and what makes it so watchable, is that it's like it's Tarantino's kung fu movie,
yeah.
and Volume 2 is his Western. So do you just find a tone in editing it that's just sort of the middle of that, I guess?
To make it one movie.
To make it one movie.
Sure.
Yeah,
well, it's interesting in that, you know, when you do break it down, one maybe is kung fu movie, but it's definitely more... I mean, half of it is like Japanese, like martial arts.
Yeah,
right. With the Hanzo swords and all that, and so much of it takes place in Japan. And this one does feel a little bit more rooted in like the kung fu like movie style with the character of Pai Mei.
Sure.
And you know, because Pai Mei is literally a character in Shaw Brothers movies, right? And that Tarantino would have watched. And it's actually based on an actual historical figure that is, there's a martial arts style that's named after this figure. And it's kind of like, he's kind of like a villainous character. And his martial arts style, like the Pai Mei style, is a little bit more like for like villains and bad guys use it, which is very interesting that Bill would kind of send all of his proteges to train under Pai Mei. So I feel like, while this part two is definitely fits more into the Western genre, there is more of the like Chinese movie, kung fu movies, like base. And then the first volume one has a little bit more of that Japanese style with the samurai swords and all of that. But I think they're both just this love letter to these like 60s and 70s kung fu movies.
Definitely.
In general. But yeah, I think, Nicholas, like you were saying, Scott and I too, if we're ever going to watch a Kill Bill movie, we're definitely going to go to Volume 1.
We were just watching it. We were just watching Volume 1 in October around the 20-year, and of course, we just watched Volume 1.
Yeah, and that's the thing. As we were doing our rewatch as well, I was thinking, man, I've seen this movie countless times. I know it like the back of my hand. And Volume 2, we're watching it again, and like you said, it was almost like a new experience. I hadn't seen it all the way through in so long. I do think it's a good movie, but it definitely, we were like, okay, what can we talk about? I think what we can definitely talk about in this discussion right now are the characters that we didn't get to from the first movie. Mostly L. Driver. I mean, I want to talk about Daryl Hannah.
She's so fierce. And Michael Madsen really good in this movie.
No, Michael Madsen is
okay,
really good.
Okay, so we got a listener comment when we were talking about the divas. And I think that we talk about on that movie that we weren't really sure if their snakes are like, if their snakes are kind of...
What are their attributes?
Yes.
Why are they named after these specific snake types? And like, Nicholas, do you remember off the top of your head like what each code name referred to? Because we'll get
so
into
we have,
it right now.
We have Black Mamba.
Right.
We have Cottonmouth.
Cottonmouth, yep.
Which one's Cottonmouth?
I think that's Lucy Liu.
Okay.
Yep, yeah, okay. It's Lucy Liu.
L Driver would have been Rattlesnake?
California Mountain
She's
Snake.
California Mountain Snake.
Mountain Snake, okay. And then Vivica, who would she...
Vivica was not Copperhead. She was... Yeah, she was Copperhead.
Yep.
Copperhead, okay.
So then who's mm-hmm. Bud then?
Bud is not on here. I'll find it. Sorry.
But, yeah. But we'll look it up. So our listener Andrew posted on Facebook on our episode posting. So listening to this now, the reason the divas are given certain code names is because their behavior of the particular snake correlates to their characters. Black Mamba equals the deadliest. Copperhead equals they will avoid fights if possible. Coffee and a chat, but they're also ambushers, the gun. California Mountain Snake equals not actually a viper, but does kill other snakes. Poison in her sleep. Cottonmouth equals flashy movements as an intimidation tactics. Cutting the guy's head off is the way that she puts her arms out before the final fight, and her style of movements and technique is very elaborate and almost theatrical.
Bud is a Sidewinder.
Okay, sure.
that's left off of that little clip. But
and then he also noted another thing. The reason L uses poison is because California mountain snakes aren't venomous.
Okay.
So I think that I think that just this character has to like bring poison into it.
Okay, interesting. I know in a lot of movies where there's like a villain code or whatever, I feel like using poison is usually seen as a little bit more like cowardly.
Right. And Bill calls her out on that.
Yeah.
When she picks up the phone.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. But I think Daryl Hannah plays this character so well because she's just so pissed off.
Yeah. But thanks Andrew for that like enlightening.
Oh yeah,
little,
listener,
like, Andrew Baldwin, like thanks for that comment.
Yeah, that was really good because we were talking about it in the first episode. We were just and I was like trying to scour Wikipedia and like the IMDb trivia, but it was difficult to track that
down.
I
especially like the little character note about Copperhead. They avoid fights if possible, coffee and a chat, and their ambushers the gun. Mm-hmm. We love Vivica A. Fox in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, Vivica was great in the first one. So L Driver's just super pissed off the entire time. We've got some mysteries that are being solved in part two, right? Because she's got an eye patch in the first movie, and we discover how she lost her eye in this one. So it's kind of cool that we get some like setups and payoffs with the sequel.
There's also a setup in volume one with her grabbing the eye too. In the fight of in the House of the Blue Leaves, doesn't she grab somebody's eye?
She one of the crazy 88s. She pulls one of their eyes out, which was gross. I mean, it's so interesting that like part one is just that hyper violence is kind of present in this movie in some of the fight scenes, but it's just so much like. The stylized blood and all of these things and the gore and some of the shots with the limbs getting cut off and all of that. And that it's not really present in this one, but it's there when it needs to be.
I definitely notice in chapter 6, Massacre at Two Pines, that this is really the first time in these movies where you get extended amounts of dialogue with characters just talking in this quiet moment when she excuses herself. And she walks outside of the church and she sees Bill and they have a conversation. And that's a quieter moment that you do not get in part one. Sure. And you get kind of the classic Tarantino dialogue too.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's definitely something that stuck out with me in this revisit were moments like that you don't really get in volume one.
Right. The scene in the church, I feel like goes on a little too long.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I don't know. You're so hyped up with the action and the set pieces from the first one that the quieter moments in this movie sometimes to me feel a little like I'm just waiting for something to happen. I don't know. Do either of you feel that way?
I think it was kind of Tarantino's way of really communicating that we're going for something different in this movie since it's so early in the movie.
Sure. Okay. And we see Sam Jackson there.
Yep.
Making a cameo, which is kind of fun. What do you think of like all of her friends?
I was wondering if they were coworkers from the record store.
Oh, because the husband
one of them might be related to the husband too, like a sister or something.
I thought that group of girls was very interesting because we don't really get a lot of backstory from them. They're just kind of there. They talk and it seems like they've got some like attitude happening. But I got a little. Death Proof?
Sure. They remind me of the girls from Death Proof. Yeah. I get
you
that.
You know,
too.
Just this girl, this just group of friends that are just kind of like they're tough when they need to be, but they're I don't know. It's interesting that you're kind of thrown into this group of people and you're like, oh, okay, well, this is, you know.
They seem really protective. But also like they haven't known her that long, right? They haven't been a friend group for Uma hasn't been there that long with them.
Just a matter of months, yeah.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing that we do, you know, you're kind of thinking like how long has she had to like integrate herself into these people's lives and they're like right there at the, you know, at her wedding to this guy. Yeah, all that's it's interesting. It sets a lot more of the bride and Bill. What do we think of the idea of her name being kind of obscured in the first movie, and then we find out her name in this one? I mean,
I didn't really understand it.
Yeah, same.
Well, because
I'm trying
her,
to understand the significance.
Because he calls her "Hey kiddo," you think that's just like a term of endearment, right? Until you find
out. Yeah, not
her
last name.
It's her last
name.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, Nick, like you, I've always, to this day, I'm just kind of like, what's the significance? And maybe, I don't know, maybe we're missing something.
Beatrix Kiddo.
We have to be.
I mean, Beatrix Kiddo just seems like if you were like a woman on the lam.
That's just a silly name. It sounds like a fake name.
Like a witness protection name.
It sounds like a fake. Or it sounds like a screenwriter kind of made up name. But yeah, maybe I'm thinking too deep into it. Is like there needs to be some significance of.
There has to be some sort of a reference there.
Throughout the first movie, hidden through the first half of this movie, they bleep it out. I forgot. I thought they name her right away, but. They bleep it out a few times in this movie. A couple times.
Like, what was the significance of Elle being the one to use her name first? Or
right.
Without it being bleeped?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we're not thinking hard enough about it. There's got to be something in there, you know. But on this rewatching, I think the three of us are still just like, okay, work. it's there. We don't get it. It's scholarly. It's just something cool for us to latch onto. But I do happen to think that the name Beatrix Kiddo is a little crazy. It's mm-hmm. a little like, girl, what? Come
it's
on.
It's like,
all right.
All right. We get it, Quentin.
All right, Quentin. Yeah. This is the same person that wrote in the credits on the movie, like inspired by characters created by Q and U. Which I'm like, all right, come on, shut up. maybe I'm being a little too hard on Quinn.
So before we get into L Driver, let's just kind of go chapter wise.
Okay.
So I mean, chapter 6, the massacre at Two Pines, where we kind of get the proper introduction to Bill as a character.
Right. Good shot in that at the end of the scene where the crane is in the church over Bill's shoulder and it pulls out the door. And
you see the divas
walk
lined up,
yeah. And it's the ends, and it's the beginning of, you know, the actual massacre. I think that's a really fun, that's a really cool shot.
I really love the shot, which is kind of his John Ford framing of Uma in the door. It's from The Searchers.
From inside looking
one
at
of the most iconic images of movie history, particularly Westerns,
right.
Is just kind of how John Ford frames John Wayne in this door. And I think that shot bookends The Searchers, so he puts it as a little homage in this movie. So chapter 7, The Lonely Grave of Paula Schultz.
All right.
So I love the character of Bud because I'm very fascinated with this character. I think that these scenes were probably shot in like Barstow. I could see
Bud.
Well,
it's set in Barstow.
Yeah, it's set in Barstow, and I could see Bud as that type of desert dirtbag that lives in a trailer in Barstow. Michael Madsen, and there's just something about Michael Madsen's face that you can kind of see in his prime, he was super handsome.
Well, he's in
Thelma and Louise.
Yeah,
I think he's
we
super
talk
sexy
about it.
In Thelma and Louise.
We talk about it in Thelma and Louise. We talk about it with Millie, our friend Millie DeCherico, that, yeah, he's kind of supposed to be a dirtbag in that movie. Mm-hmm. But even then, which is less than 10 years,
yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, we get it. We see it. But yeah, this whole, you were saying that this is kind of a prototype of the Brad Pitt character in Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, definitely. This is the Brad Pitt character. No, I'm blanking. This is Cliff Booth on
Booth?
Hard Times.
Yeah.
This is Cliff Booth on Hard Times, living out in this trailer, being a bouncer at a strip club. He tells Bill that he has pawned the sword too. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Bill and Bud are brothers. Did we know that in the first movie?
I think there might be a reference to them being brothers in the first script. I can't remember.
It's interesting that this group of assassins that Bill has pulled together are all women. It's like this all-female group. And then Bud. I mean,
and then his little brother.
Yeah, you know, is it that thing
I
of
guess,
like?
I guess I just have to include my little like, brother.
Sure, you can start. Sure, you can start an assassin, you know, gang, but make sure to take your brother with you. Kind of a thing. So yeah, I don't know. I just always thought that was interesting that Bud is like part of this group. But you know, Scott brought up this point as we're watching it, and he's like, "Well, is it just because?" I guess we'll call her Beatrix. Just because Beatrix decided, hey, I want out, that like, that's why they're going to kill her. And I'm like, well, yeah, I feel like that's like a rule, like in like the mafia or like street gangs or whatever, that like you can't just walk away, right? You have to like mm-hmm. either get jumped out or like, or they just knock rub you out, you know? Like, that's what I assumed. But then there's Bud sitting in his trailer jerking off like, being a bouncer at a strip club. Well, so he gets to walk away because he's Bill's younger brother.
Well, I think it's...
So he gets to just say, I'm not going to do this anymore.
So I think that Beatrix was kind of the glue holding the Divas together. And once they took it out, they just...
Fell apart?
They all just fell apart.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, because I guess Vivica's out too now. Mm-hmm. So she didn't get killed. She left and now she's raising her kid and has a husband. Under a fake
Do you
name.
Think maybe it's just the way Uma Thurman left? Like she kind of just right. left in the night, made Bill think she was dead. I mean, right. he brought that up, you know?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I guess, I mean, she does say that it's his baby. So it's implied that they were having like a romantic relationship. So.
Which we should talk about.
Because later on she introduces him as her father.
Yeah.
Because he's that old. Yeah, that's an interesting kind of angle on all of this, but you know, to each their own. Daddy
yeah,
issues.
I just love Bud in the high desert as a bouncer at the strip club, gets in trouble with the boss for showing up late, and just kind of this assassin's downfall is that now he's sure. just living outside of Barstow. In this trailer.
Maybe he was never that good at it. Maybe he never really wanted to do it. And he was just like, Bill was just like, do something with your life. Join the Divas.
Be a diva.
Be a diva.
We've got a spot open for you.
Be a diva. I've got a spot. It's got your name on it. Come on.
Literally.
You know? But yeah, I also love that exchange where Bill comes over to his trailer too. And they're talking about Beatrix is like on a rampage. She just took out Oren Ishii and her entire crazy 88s. So yeah. You better watch out.
Isn't there a comment about 88? He's like, yeah. Oh, are there 88 of them? And he's like, no, not really 88 of them.
She just calls him that.
I don't dodge guilt and I don't chew out of paying my comeuppance. Can we just forget the past? That woman deserves her revenge. And we deserve to die. But then again, so does she. So I guess... You'll see.
Bill speculated they picked this name because it sounded cool. There's actually 40 actors credited as Crazy 88. Seems like, I mean, if you told me she cut down 88 people, I'd have been like,
that's about right.
That's a long, very long scene. But yeah, that's an interesting clip because we hear that line from Bud in the first movie.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like...
She deserves her vengeance and we deserve to die, mm-hmm. right? But then it's not the whole line. And then he laughs it off and he says something more and like, oh, okay. It's all about context. I love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the beginning part of that is interesting too because Bill's just like, you need to be more worried, dude.
You need to be more worried and why did you fucking pawn that sword? Which is kind of a clever... set up and payoff of the script too,
right?
Of when they find it in the trailer.
Yeah, and meanwhile, it's just sitting in like an umbrella stand, like 3 feet away from Bill, right? It's the scene where, you know, the lonely grave of Paula Schultz, all of this stuff that happens, him like shooting her with a shotgun full of rock salt and like binding her up and throwing her in a cedar box in a grave and burying her alive. Like, whew, that shit is intense.
I also read that Beatrix does not speak to Bud.
Which I read that too.
Yep, which I didn't really, I mean, that also didn't really register, but she kind of, she's paralyzed for most of her scenes with them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, but yeah, all that stuff gets like, the claustrophobia and anxiety in me, I get a little like, ooh, I don't like this scene.
I love the shot of when they're digging the grave and the actual grave of the coffin of Paula Schultz is like off to the corner and she's sort of making like bunny ears.
What?
Yeah. Paula Schultz's like corpse is kind of making like bunny ears.
With their hands?
With their hands. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you go back and rewatch the scene, yep.
I did not notice that.
Well, what did Paula Schultz do to deserve this is all I'm saying.
It's kind of an ingenious way to get rid of somebody.
But what do they do with her body?
Yeah, where's Paula going?
Mm-hmm.
And who's this guy that's like Bud's like...
Igor, his accomplice?
Yes, his little Igor guy is like so creepy. You're like, ooh. Who is this man that is just fully on board with all of this? He's just like, yeah, okay. Let's dig this grave for this still living woman and like nail her in this coffin and throw her in. He's just like, yep. What else you need me to do? So from here, it leads us to her backstory with Pai Mei, which built up to her getting out of being buried alive.
Classic Netflix.
Oh, gosh.
If you were watching this movie on Netflix, that you probably realized that there are no subtitles in this scene. So we had to stop the Netflix copy and go and break out our old DVD. So I'm glad that we still have our old DVD.
Yeah.
So I didn't do that, and I'm watching the Netflix copy, and I'm like, I know I can understand him. I know I've been able to...
Right?
Figure out what he is saying.
Did you think you were crazy?
I thought I was crazy, and I didn't have my DVD copy, so I had to shuffle through it and be like, context clues, it's fine.
Yeah. No, I thought at first I was like, okay, because we watched Volume 1 on Netflix, and Volume 1 on Netflix, it didn't just give you the subtitles right away. You had to go in and put on English subtitles for the whole thing, right? So even the English dialogue was there, but the Japanese dialogue was on screen. You know, everything from Oren Ishii, it was all there. So when this scene started, I was like, oh, I forgot we didn't turn the subtitles on. So then we did, and then still nothing. And I was like, maybe there isn't subtitles and we're just supposed to figure it out, like you said, using context clues.
Well, because,
but then I was like, no, I remember
Scorsese. Well, and also I mean, that's becoming a big thing with movies because Scorsese just did it in Killers of the Flower Moon,
right?
That some of the native dialogue you have subtitles and then some you just kind of have to figure it out,
right. But then I was remembering understanding what he's saying to her. Like, I was remembering him like calling her a donkey and like all this stuff, and I was just like, no, that's there, like, what the frick. So I was like, you know, we're gonna have to pause it, let's just stop. So we did just move to our new apartment, so we have all of our DVDs separate from the Blu-rays, separate from the 4Ks, and I knew exactly where they were, so I was like, I got it.
It was laying in the top of the box.
It was right in the top, and yeah, so we just like opened one box, and there it was, and we just popped it in, and not as clean of a transfer as Netflix. You know, DVDs are not optimized for these, you know, flat screen TVs, but we were able to understand what he was saying, and that was a lot more helpful. But like I said, this character of Pai Mei, I think it means something like white eyebrows, something like that. And if you go back and you watch these Shaw Brothers movies, let me see. He is in Executioners from Shaolin, Abbot of Shaolin, and Clan of the White Lotus. And in this movie, he is played by Gordon Liu. Gordon Liu does not play Pai Mei in the Shaw Brothers movies in the 70s. He is in those movies that feature the character, but he's not playing the character. And then before that, the character himself in these Kung Fu movies is based on, he is said to have been one of the legendary five elders, survivors of the destruction of the Shaolin Monastery by the Qing Dynasty, who, according to some accounts, betrayed the Shaolin to the imperial government, and he shares his name with the South Chinese martial art attributed to him. So there is I believe it's Bak Mei.
Okay.
Kung Fu style. And like I said, he is kind of more known as more of a villainous character. But one of his like attributes is close contact. I'm trying to find the quote in here, but it's like close contact fighting, which kind of leads to the whole like one inch punch that he's trying to teach her the entire time. You know, this like, you know, this close quarters punch that she uses to get out of the coffin. And I remember watching this for the first time in the theater and just being fascinated with this idea of just like, you know, putting your hand up perpendicular to a board and just like punching through and trying to get it. And I was just like, at what point am I just like, just pluck out both my eyeballs and push me down the stairs? Like, I'm not
sure.
I'm not finishing this.
Well, I mean, El Driver couldn't do it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting when at the very, very beginning, Bill comes down the stairs and he's just like, fuck those stairs. And then he's like, okay, he's going to take you on as a student. He hates Americans. He hates white people and he hates women. And you're all three.
Good luck.
Right. Good luck. And she's just like, okay. And he goes, yeah, he'll warm up to you after the first year. And you're like, holy shit.
Okay. I heard year and I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
What are we doing for a year?
The first year, right? So this is implying that this is a multi-year like course that she's on. Does she get summer vacation? Does she get like Easter and Christmas off? Like,
who's doing her taxes? Right? Like, the IRS doesn't care if you're going into the forest to learn Kung Fu.
Hey, she has been living underground for a while. So then I kind of feel like at the beginning of this scene when she's like sitting in the Jeep, like waiting, and he's telling her all this, I feel like she's playing it off, Uma Thurman is playing it off a little bit more like, okay, like whatever you want, Bill, like,
sure,
I'll go do this. But then when she gets up there, she's like, oh no, bitch, I'm proficient at the samurai sword and I fully already speak Japanese and I kind of understand half of what you're saying. So I was a little confused. At first I thought it was like she's just this young girl that's like swept up in Bill and all this shit, but it seems like she already has a lot under her belt by the time she gets there. But it is very interesting that, yeah, she's just like, hey, I know the ways of the katana, I know the ways of the samurai sword. And he's just like, fuck that, this is not what you're doing here. Like, this is a completely new style. And much like something like Crouching Tiger, like, yeah, they use swords, but they're very different than the sword work that we've seen in the first movie.
Did you notice the setup and payoff of Beatrix's, I think it's her right hand, when he takes her right hand and he says, this is my hand now.
Uh-huh.
And that's the hand that she pulls L's eye out with. So it's it's like this.
He got his revenge.
This character's got his revenge because this is his arm.
Okay. Yep. Okay.
Just kind of little things that you miss
when
you first watch this movie or you've forgotten.
Right.
Yep.
Now, do you think L Driver is already an established diva when Uma Thurman goes through? So, like, right, because, you know, L kills Pai Mei. When? Like, when did she kill Pai Mei?
Right.
She would have had to have gone right after her.
Mm-hmm.
I think L is before. I think L went before.
And then
she feels like she's more of an established, like, mercenary.
Yeah, I agree.
Assassin.
And then she came back for him right after Beatrix was there. It makes sense why this character hates Beatrix so much, too.
Because she completed the training with both eyes intact. Yeah. And it seems like Beatrix has this affinity for Paimei. Like, after all that, and like, this is my arm now, and the bloody hands, and use your chopsticks, and all that. At the end of it all, like, that's her master. And like, they're, like, he does grow to respect her, I think. Right?
I mean, enough to teach her the, oh my gosh, the five palm,
yeah,
the five finger palm,
five,
you know,
point, 5-point palm,
exploding heart technique.
Yeah. Because when Bill is surprised that she knows it, which indicates mm-hmm. that he didn't teach it to everybody, right?
Yeah, that's, I mean, what it, I has took. To frustrate Bill because he is this big killing machine.
Yeah. I did read that originally it was 10-point palm exploding heart technique, and that's just too much.
Sure.
10 points. I wasn't got time for 10 points.
Easier for Uma to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I think you're right, Nick. I think that is a timeline that L went first, and then, and maybe that's why Paimei is so rough on Beatrix. It's because he's already had this.
He just had to deal with the other one.
This
I just had to rip her eye
bitch.
Out.
Yeah.
Don't make me rip your eyes out.
Yeah, exactly. I already had this huge blonde bitch coming at me, you know, talking all this shit. Now here's another one, you know. Did he send all of them there?
I don't think Bud went.
I don't know. Bud definitely.
Bud definitely did not go.
Go.
Okay. One of the
Bud
benefits
was
just an of
honorary
being
member.
Yes.
One of the benefits of being Bill's
brother.
But I would imagine that Oren Ishii went.
Sure. Yeah. Because she's also proficient with the samurai sword, and you know everything
she was
else.
Probably in and out within like a month.
She's half Chinese. Maybe she spoke a little bit of it as well. Okay. But I think those scenes are really cool. I know they went to China for that. You know, they shot in the mountains there, and just this idea of this character, which really harkens back to these kung fu movies with like the wig and the beard and all that. It's just such a like moment from a very specific genre of these kung fu films just like thrown in here. I also read, and I'm sure you guys probably read as well, that Quentin's original idea was for the actor to say all of his lines in Mandarin and for it to be dubbed into English.
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't know who talked him out of that. Harvey, maybe.
Probably.
But ultimately they didn't do that, and he just spoke it in Mandarin and we just got subtitles.
I mean, if you had to rank scenes where a character is buried alive, I would imagine that this is probably the best ever committed to film. Of when she's digging herself, when she's...
Isn't there a whole Ryan Reynolds movie where he's in a...
Buried.
Where he's in a coffin the entire time?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes.
Have you seen that one, Scott?
I have not seen Buried. Okay. So maybe I can't quite... I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is the best buried alive scene ever put on film.
It is...
Well, if you're going to... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go for it.
If you're going to bury Beatrix, shouldn't you at least sit by the gravesite for a few hours, a few days, to make sure she's dead?
Yeah.
She's
the
deadliest woman.
Crack open a beer, just kind of wait there for a little bit.
He should have left Igor there.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, what else are they doing, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He got fired.
That's true. He doesn't have to go to work the next day. He has
a Hanzo sword to pawn with, you know, $1 million he's about to make off his sword. So, I mean...
Well, now he's got two now.
Yeah, two Hanzo sword. One inscribed, one not.
Yeah, yeah. But also, yeah, this is just not good hitman work. Like, she's already bound and gagged and tied up and in a coffin. Boom, one shot. I've got a gun in my room. I can go get it right now. How about no?
So we opened up the episode with L talking to Bud when he gets bitten by the Black Mamba.
Oh, Lord.
And what I love about that scene is that L does say she deserved better. She deserved better than to be kind of shot by you, paralyzed, and buried alive. Like, that's not the ending of this. That's not the ending that this woman deserves. Like, she kind of deserved more, and I like that L has that moment.
Well, that's interesting, too, because she didn't think that as much when she had a syringe full of poison.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like a year ago.
Elle's kind of a right? series of contradictions.
Because she was, when yeah. it was her going to take her out, oh, you don't owe her shit. But when it's Bud.
You thought that was pretty fucking funny, yeah, didn't you?
It was pretty fucking funny, didn't you?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so I just want to say from now on, I'm not currently a regular smoker, but if I ever do take up smoking again, I am going to smoke with my left arm completely perpendicular to my body and my hand just coming into the side. Yeah, because that shit was like looks crazy and I love it. Fun fact, maybe not a fun fact, but it is a fun fact that I was always fascinated with, and I would always see this in my grandmother's National Enquirers. Daryl Hannah is missing the tip of her index finger on I forget which hand. But not the hand that she was holding the cigarette in.
Not because the smoking
you could,
hand.
Because you okay. could see both fingers.
Both little tips.
I think it was the hand that she was holding the phone, and her sleeves were really long, like her cuffs, because she's wearing the suit, the black suit with the white dress shirt, and the cuffs on her sleeve are kind of long, kind of obscuring her hand holding her 90s cell phone. But because I thought, and then she's got like a Band-Aid on one finger, so I was like, oh, maybe that's the one, but it was her middle finger. So I was trying to like figure out, but they do a really good job in this movie of obscuring it, and Daryl does a really good job. Daryl Hannah, the person, does a good job, being that she's an actress and she's on camera, of kind of obscuring her hands and knowing how to show her hands, and it's not gross. It's not like her whole finger's missing. It's literally just like
a little tip.
The fingernail is down, you know, is gone. So it's just a little short. But that's just and I would always see it in my grandma's National Enquirers. It would always
things
show
that
like,
you didn't know about stars.
Yes. Yeah. Or just weird things about their bodies or whatever.
Star imperfections.
Yes. And being that she's just such this like beautiful, like statuesque, like iconic fashion supermodel. Oh well, guess what? She's deformed. Mm-hmm. No, she's not.
Oh, I just Googled it. Wow.
And then in the pictures you can see like weird candid shots or whatever. But yeah, it's and it's there the whole time. And I don't think they just do some really interesting things with maybe wardrobe. And again, Daryl just knows how to hold herself and her hands in ways that obscure it. But there's some really extreme close ups of her holding a cell phone and like smoking cigarettes and doing all this stuff, and you'd never know. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how fun that fact is, but
it works for the role, right? Even if you looked at this movie and thought that they did it just for the movie, it would make sense, right?
Oh,
you
know, totally.
Casualties happen. She's missing an eye. You're missing a fingertip. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, great, great.
Maybe it was something that Quentin tried to talk Daryl into.
Right.
That we should get a good shot of your hand and cheek.
And she's like, we're good.
No, we're good. Chapter 9, L and I, which I'm just now seeing the pun of this chapter.
L and I.
L and I. Yep. I love this. I think this is the best. These are some of the best moments of the movie, is this.
Absolutely.
This fight scene with Uma and Daryl is so much fun.
Right.
I remember it won Best Fight at the MTV Movie Awards, and I mentioned in the last episode that she dedicated her golden popcorn to Margaret Hamilton from The Wizard of Oz, because that was just a big inspiration for how bitchy Elle Driver is.
So, okay. Uma Thurman is credited on Google, 6 foot tall, and Daryl, oh, see, now 5'11". See, I'm seeing different things.
Just under 6 foot.
And I think Daryl is also 5'11". So this is, they're a good match. I think I said this in the last one. They're a good match for each other, just these like tall blonde women. But something else that I read is that they didn't get along. They didn't get along with each other.
Too.
You read that too. And that, you know, for the press tour, that like Uma specifically was just like, let's just try and figure this out so that we're just on different ends of the step and repeat. You know, we just don't do the same interviews at the same time. And Uma went to the 2004 Movie Awards and accepted her Best Fight with her and Gogo, but she didn't go the year that she won.
The following year.
With Daryl. And Daryl went by herself.
So I also heard that Daryl was taken off the press tour because of friction with Harvey Weinstein, too.
Sure.
Which very well could have been the case.
Yeah. And Daryl Hannah, I think, is just kind of known for just being a little. I hate to overuse the term kooky, but I mean, she's a little kooky, and I eccentric. Think she's a little yep. eccentric. But I also think that she has a mind of her own, which is great, and she's not afraid to speak. She's been in the business for a long time. And so I think she's just like, if she doesn't like somebody, she's just not going to pretend that she does. Mm-hmm. So if it's Uma Thurman or if it's the head of the studio, I think she was probably just like, fuck this. I don't need to promote this movie. Like, if I need to deal with Harvey Weinstein, then just take me off the damn tour.
Yeah.
She doesn't like doing press anyway. So it's interesting. Daryl Hannah is a very interesting character just as a person in general. We've talked about it in our Steel Magnolias, and you know, it's just, she's just a little cuckoo, but I kind of love her for it.
We just rewatched Steel Magnolias, and her performance is the one that really stood out in this so revisit good. That I'm like, Daryl's doing some fine work in this role.
She really is.
Yeah, she's really good. Her delivery of talking to Bud when he's on the floor after getting bit by the Black Mamba in the face. This is how this is how unhinged this woman is putting the world's deadliest snake in a briefcase full of cash and
$1 million.
$1 million, and Bud gets like bit right between the eyes with it.
Three times.
And I think that Daryl is so good when she's reading off her notepad.
In Africa, the saying goes, in the bush, an elephant can kill you, a leopard can kill you, and a black mamba can kill you. But only with the mamba, and this has been true in Africa since the dawn of time, is death sure. Hence its handle, Death Incarnate. Pretty cool, huh? Its neurotoxic venom is one of nature's most effective poisons, acting on the nervous system, causing paralysis. The venom of a black mamba can kill a human being in 4 hours, if, say, bitten on the ankle or the thumb. However, a bite to the face or torso can bring death from paralysis within 20 minutes. Now, you should listen to this, because this concerns you. The amount of venom that can be delivered from a single bite can be gargantuan. You know, I've always liked that word, gargantuan. I so rarely have an opportunity to use it in a sentence.
I think that she's so much fun in that scene.
No, absolutely. I like that she has her little notepad that she like writes this like
kind of like a little
waitress notepad.
Yeah. Gargantuan. Don't you love that word? Hardly get a chance to use it.
Yeah, no, she's great.
Are you expecting Beatrix to pull her eye out? Are you thinking that that's what's going to happen at any point in that fight scene?
I had forgotten that she did it in this rewatch. So I thought it was pretty surprising.
Mm-hmm. And then she steps on it. She proceeds yep. to step on steps the on eyeball.
And this is how kind of gangster Beatrix is after all of this fight, like tearing up this trailer, tearing up this piece of shit trailer from Bud, pulling out her eye, stepping on it. And she is like flailing around. Okay, Pete, did you get the Blade Runner reference when she's in the bathroom, like flailing sure. around? It's kind of like, mm-hmm. yeah. it's kind of like how the character dies in Blade Runner.
Right.
Yeah. It's exactly yep. like the same movement and everything.
Yeah. Pris just like throwing her body all over the place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just like out, like literally out of control of like her body.
But I think yeah. there's something really interesting and kind of gangster of how the bride just walks away. And I love that.
Right.
Like
right.
she just leaves her alone in this trailer blind with the world's most poisonous snake somewhere in the trailer.
Yeah. And, you know, there's broken glass everywhere. She's bleeding profusely from a lost eye. It's like, she's probably going to die anyway. She's just like, what, you know, why bother? I'm out. Peace. Mm-hmm. I'm taking your cool car and I'm taking my sword and I'm getting the fuck out.
I just love how Daryl is also drinking this stiff margarita as this is all happening.
Bud making margarita, blending margaritas as this conversation is, that is very Quentin Tarantino. Sure. Just like him spilling like these margaritas everywhere. Mm-hmm. I remember what I was going to say. When they're on the phone and Bud is just like, okay, I caught her. She's got a Hanzo sword. And Elle's like, she's got a Hanzo sword. I'm there. And it's like, okay, cool. $1 million. See you tomorrow morning. And Elle's just like, cool, $1 million, cash, got you.
I can do it.
I'll see you in 12 hours.
I'll see you there tomorrow morning.
And the, not only does she show up with $1 million, I mean, I'm assuming it's there. The snake's in there. So maybe it's not all, maybe it's Monopoly money under a couple of stacks of, you know, stacks of cash. But not only does she show up with $1 million in a briefcase, but she went out and got herself this damn snake.
Sure.
And shoved it in there.
She somehow knows a exotic animal
right.
wrangler to get this but deadly snake.
It's mm-hmm. just this like underworld life that they all are a part of, where A, you can ask somebody, can you bring me $1 million by tomorrow?
I mean, she probably just had it buried in the yard.
Mm-hmm. You know? And he's like, you know, Elle can probably get access to that kind of money. And he doesn't ask for like $10 million. He's just asked for $1 million, right? It's a lot, but it's not too much. It's gettable. I know she has access to it somewhere. Like you said, she's probably just has it somewhere. And she knows she can make most of it back with the sword. So, hey, win-win. And Elle is just like, sure, why not? Even if for some reason he gets away with it for a minute, I'll get him back eventually. So yeah, it's this underworld that they live in. Like you said, like who's paying Beatrix taxes? I think they're just so underground that they're just completely like not on the grid. Their names don't exist. They don't exist.
They're not
like,
they're not getting a W-4.
No, they're not getting I-9s, you know, none of that shit. It's just so interesting that this underworld and like in the States, in Asia, all over the world, that they're all just like, they move in this crazy life that they, and that's why when Beatrix is like, hey, now that I know I'm pregnant, I'm going to get out. It's just like, but can you, like, how can you, like, so many people know who you are or want you dead, or, you know, it's like, It's wild. Who knows if that actually does exist, this kind of, you know, black market, like underworld of hitmen and all that. I'm sure it does. But it's fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's
definitely. Yeah.
But yeah, I do love Scott that Beatrix is just like, all right, this is it. I'm going to let this one finish.
I'm done.
I'm going to let you do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. I got mine. I got my sword. You know, Bud's dead. Let's hit it. Right.
And she takes off in this car. Okay, so we're going into the last chapter face to face.
Yeah.
And something that I do think that we need to address, that there's something about this movie that kind of hangs over you when you're watching it. And, I mean, I hate to segue with the car, but yeah, it is the real life incident that happened to Uma Thurman, the person, when they were filming this movie. I think it was towards the end of production, but it was the scenes with the car.
Yeah.
That in 2018, Uma Thurman posted a video of her doing the stunt when she was driving fast, and she injures herself.
Right.
And the Weinsteins really tried hard to cover it up.
Right.
And Quentin Tarantino, when I think that he was going through some of his kind of personal videos, just kind of stuff that was not used as they were editing, he found the actual footage of her crashing the car.
Yeah.
And he still kind of had this guilt over him that he handed it to Uma to post.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a thing about the legacy of this movie and kind of the legacy of just Miramax in general, of that when you're looking at the production of these movies, I mean, we don't have to go too far into just the legacy of Harvey Weinstein and Miramax, but some pretty terrible things happened in those decades that the studio kind of reigned. And Uma was kind of a casualty of something like that. I mean, I think that filming a movie like this is a lot of hard work that you have to put actors in uncomfortable situations. I mean, Uma was coming off of all of this stunt work that Quentin just assumed, well, we're going to have you in this convertible and you're going to be going fast enough to get these shots of you with your hair blowing. And Uma felt very, very uncomfortable in the moment when filming. It was a dirt road. She didn't want to go that fast. She didn't feel like the car was safe enough. And then Quentin made her do it.
She asked for a stunt driver, and there were no stunt drivers on set that day. Mm-hmm. And so he's just like, we got to get it. You're here. it's a car, you know how to drive.
Yeah.
It was an old car. It was a Karmann Ghia Volkswagen. Great car, is solid, but I mean, if you're not used to driving specific cars, if you get behind the wheel of a new car for the first time, you're just like, okay. And then on a dirt road in a different country, like all this shit, and it just like, it just slipped. It lost traction and she ran into a tree.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the Weinsteins tried to cover it up, tried to get the footage buried, kind of really trying to bury all of this so it would not come out as they were making the movie. And Quentin has said that it's the biggest regret of his life, getting her to do that stunt. And it was literally the happiest day this year when his assistant Shannon found the footage and sent it to me, and I knew I was going to be able to present it to Uma. So, and I would imagine that their relationship just in general is probably very complicated of when you're making a movie like this. I think that they're on good terms now. Maya Hawke, her daughter, was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That I would imagine that Maya probably would not have done that movie had they were not in a good place. But it's the kind of one of the things about discussing this movie that you kind of have to talk about.
Yeah, it's a sticky situation, and it's unfortunate. And I think he probably holds a little bit more regret of not giving her the footage and kind of not sticking with her when she tried to, you know, make these claims at the time, and just kind of sticking with the studio and just being like, you know, whatever, trying to pay her off. But because she was hurt physically, and
Uma does also have a past with Harvey Weinstein, that she was interviewed in the New York Times that she was like sexually assaulted by him in the 90s, in like the mid 90s. I mean, classic. Yeah. I mean, goes to Harvey's hotel room and he greets her wearing a robe.
Right.
And then tries to like push himself on her. So, and she kind of had that moment during Me Too where she could share that story too.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think her legacy as an actor is pretty solid. It's pretty strong. I mean, these two movies alone are just kind of like so iconic, and just her work with Tarantino, especially in, you know, starting with Kill Bill. And I think she's just she's come out of it fairly well from you know, the public standpoint.
Sure. So, yeah. Of course.
So good on her. We love you know, we can't talk about how much we love Uma Thurman on this show, but seems like you know, she made it out, you know, the other side, which is good. And you know, and she's strongly behind her daughter being in the industry, so, which is also you know, a good sign for the both of them. But I do feel like this third act of the movie is my least favorite.
Is it a hotel room with Bill, or is this kind of his house?
I think he owns this like hacienda.
Is it like an Airbnb situation?
I thought it was a house, but I read that it is a hotel.
Oh. No, because, yeah, she walks in and there's like a front desk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like she's like she drops off her car with the valet.
Right. Weird. This kid, I don't know. I'm not on board with this kid actor. Something about her delivery is weird to me. She's 4 years old, I think. The idea is the character's 4 years old. And here she is with her father, who presumably raised her. And this woman walks in and she's just like, hey, what's up, mommy?
Yeah. She knows of her mom, that her mom has been in a coma.
I don't know about this.
Her mom's been
asleep.
I don't
know what kid is just like, oh, hey, what's up, mommy? We're just playing. Mommy that I've never met before.
Yeah, the same kid who wants to watch, what was the movie, Shogun Assassin or something?
Yeah.
Raised by Bill.
I guess. Like, is that supposed to be like a joke? Like, oh, she wants to watch Shogun Assassin. Ha ha. I don't know. You know, I have a thing about precocious kids in movies. The little kid actor in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, hate that scene.
Those are always the scenes that we fast forward
it every time. Yep. Just because anytime there's, and this kid isn't that bad as far as like, she's not talking like an adult. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't know about the performance, and I don't know about the way she's presented as just being so cool with this, like, hey, there's, I guess you're my mom, and it's not affecting me whatsoever. You know, 4-year-olds are, I mean, kids are fucking weirdos. Four-year-olds are definitely weirdos. And I don't know that they're just like, hey, stranger.
Sure.
People have told me about having a mother. I guess it's you. And now I'm going to hug you and love you like you're my mom. It's not how kids work. But I don't know. Maybe because this kid was raised by Bill, they're a little different. But yeah, this last act, it's a lot of Bill monologuing.
Well, he has the whole Superman monologue with Beatrix. This is why Beatrix, she could never really be the Clark Kent, because Beatrix is Superman. I remember discussing that scene a lot in like college intro, like philosophy classes, or like freshman seminars. Oh. Is that little piece of dialogue.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, it's kind of a interesting pop culture reference because superhero movies were a thing at this time in 2003, 2004, but they're nowhere near that they are now. So this little piece of writing and this analogy would have been pretty clever.
And this is post Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin was 97. Are you talking about Batman Begins?
No, I'm talking about her movie.
Oh, yeah. This would have been a number of years after Batman and Robin. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
But then Batman Begins, I think, is like the next year. I think it's like 2005.
2005,
Or 2006. Yeah. So it was coming.
Yeah.
But just kind of putting into context of Bill's motivations of why he does it, because she could never be the Clark Kent.
Right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I just feel like, I don't know, to me it's a little weak, and to me just kind of listen to Bill monologue is a little just like, I know it's the character and it's on purpose, but I'm just like, oh my God, this guy is just so up his own ass. So that's kind of where I'm coming from when I'm watching this movie, and I'm just like, okay, let's just get it over with. Let's just fucking kill Bill. Let's just kill him and be done with it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think what's the end goal for Bill? Like, does Bill know, okay, like, I expect to die by her. Like, she's going to kill me, or do I have to kill her and then explain to the kid why I have to kill your mom? Like, what?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because we find out that he has been telling the daughter about her whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's not as if he just found out she was alive, so now he's going to tell the daughter about her. The kid's like, oh, no, Daddy tells me about you all the time. So, I don't know. What was his end game all along? And now,
I mean, surely it's not a happy ever after with the two of them raising her. Like, that's not an option at this point.
Yeah. And then, and every time Beatrix does, like, go for a sword or go for a gun or something, he tries to shoot her, or shows her that he can shoot her or kill her, you know, at any moment. So it's not like he does have this like, oh, but I've loved you all along, and like, yeah, let's just like be a family together. That, I don't think that's an option either. So it's ambiguous, but I think it's just her journey is so much fun that maybe finally this climax, I'm just like, I don't know what else it could have been.
Yeah.
To make it any more exciting, I
guess. Definitely a deliberate move to make it anticlimactic too.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I guess you're right, because after everything that we've seen, maybe any sort of sword fight or any sort of physical fight would have been anticlimactic, because otherwise, how would it beat everything that we saw with Oren and with Elle and with Vivica? It would be, how can we top that now? You know, so it's like, why even try? I mm-hmm. guess. Okay, so let's just keep it quiet and let's just do 5-point bomb. Boom, walks away. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of those are my thoughts on the ending of this. Not that I feel like the ending kind of negates how good the rest of it is. I feel like, you know, it's still solid. I still really enjoy this movie.
Yeah, and like, and David's really good in all of these scenes too.
David Carradine.
Mm-hmm. David Carradine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The whole truth serum thing, too.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, is that real? It's truth serum.
Well, we were watching the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Donald Glover.
Yeah.
And there's a truth serum scene in that as well. And we were talking about how silly the idea of truth serum is. And then Kill Bill again.
Yeah.
Just a couple days after. Like, oh, there it is again.
And
so.
And he talks about like sodium pentothal, which I guess is kind of like a real world.
Sure. Just these kind of lazy script devices.
I mean, hey, you're military, Nicholas. You should know these things. Tell us. Is it
No one tells me the super secret stuff.
You don't have access to truth serum. You can't kill us five ways.
Of course not.
You probably
could
kill us five ways, but we'll leave that out. All your truth serums are locked away in a safe somewhere. Sure, you don't believe in them. Wink.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, they're not real.
Oh man. But
kind of wrapping up our discussion of Kill Bill, because we're kind of getting there. What are some of our favorite moments of Volume 1 and Volume 2?
Volume 1, Oren's death, right? Amazing scene. Oh, well, the club scene before, right? They're in the restaurant, that scene right before Oren and her have the one-on-one, so...
Yeah, everything in the House of Falling Leaves.
Everything in the House of Fallen Leaves is the House of Blue Leaves. Great. Lucy Liu in her big monologue when she cuts off the guy's head. I think she's so much fun in that scene. Yeah. That's one of my favorite moments in it.
Yeah, Lucy Liu is just kind of a badass in general.
And then Volume 2, all my favorite scenes are all Daryl.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really like the stuff with Pai Mei in China.
Yeah.
I really like her training montage. You know, it's great. I think there's some really cool stunt work that we have. I mean, we had seen so much stunt work in the first movie, and then now we're seeing something in this one, and it's completely different style. So I thought it was really fun. And and then obviously all the stuff with Daryl is great. So
okay, so Tarantino did say December of 2005 when he addressed the lack of special features on the DVDs for Kill Bill, saying, I've been holding off because I've been working on it for so long that I just wanted a year off from Kill Bill, and then I'll do a big supplementary DVD package. And that...
And the lie detector determined...
Never came.
That was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I guess that the whole bloody affair, which I believe was first shown at Cannes in like 2006, 2007, they did show that at the New Beverly... very shortly, and I don't think that they've done it since.
Sure.
And I think that there are international editions of it, but it never made it to America.
Okay. So we can probably buy like a Region 2 DVD box set of everything.
I know that when you watch the whole bloody affair, that there are certain different things. I think it's transitions that are a little different. But yeah, I've never seen it. I would love to.
So you're talking about one movie cut together?
Yes.
I don't know. There's still time. Tarantino's got... once he finishes his mysterious 10th movie...
Once he finishes The Movie Critic, he's going to have a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah, so maybe we'll get a final cut of Kill Bill altogether. That'd be interesting.
I mean, and you said, what, we're on the 20th anniversary of the movies? I mean...
Yeah.
20 years?
The year is still pretty young. 20 years, we could see something. Yeah.
That's true. We could see... Maybe they're working on it right now. We didn't even know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be fun. But until then, we just have our sad old DVDs.
Our sad old DVDs that look like shit on our 4K television.
Yeah.
Or what do you guys think of the end credit scene? Which kind of leaves a little bit of ambiguity of Bill's like fate.
Sure.
I mean, there's definitely ambiguity with L because there's
the question mark.
Because there's a question mark.
Absolutely. Yeah. But everybody else also has like a slash through their name where Bill has like nothing.
That's true. Everybody's name is crossed out, and his name isn't crossed out. I don't know why they did that.
Yeah, huh. I know. I like that we get kind of the callback of all of the characters with a proper credit sequence.
The Twilight ending?
The Twilight ending. I mean, it's not quite the soap opera ending of that movie, but I liked it. I like that we get to see, love that we get to see Vivica and Lucy, and everybody kind of gets a little moment in the credits.
Yeah, that's
I mean, I don't think Volume 3 is ever going to happen. It's a fun movie to talk about, but I don't think it's ever going to be a thing.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we need it, and I don't know that it's going to. And again, I don't think that Quentin would give up a sequel to another director either.
No.
Like if it was just, "Oh, we're going to pass it off to someone else." I don't see that happening.
And I don't think that Quentin was ever really that serious about ever doing it. Too.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a story point, and it's just something that people thought up. But
would we say this is our favorite Quentin Tarantino movie?
Maybe Volume 1?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say Volume 1 or both together, right? Like if you consider it one whole story,
right?
Kill Bill, right? Absolutely.
But Scott, you love Jackie Brown.
I love Jackie Brown, and I really like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, too.
I mean, I get that Pulp Fiction
is just so influential, and it's so important of his catalog, but
yeah.
I would rather rewatch something like Kill Bill, Jackie Brown, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah.
I rewatched Inglourious Basterds a lot, I feel like, so that one's up there for me.
We still got to get Pete to watch
there
that.
There you go. Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Pete.
I know. I know. I'm just busy watching, you know, Uma Thurman chop people in half with a katana. I just really enjoy when she chops off what's her name's arm. It's just really satisifying.
Sophie.
When she chops off Sophie's arm.
Not
I'm just
you,
like, get her!
Sophie. You stay right where you are.
Yeah.
I love how Uma yells that across the room.
I'm sure Inglourious Basterds has some very satisfying fight scenes in it, but
it does.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've heard. So
early Quentin rewriting history too, which he would later do in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I really enjoy. I actually do kind of like watching kung fu movies. I feel like there was a lot that were on HBO Max for a minute, and I think they're on like Tubi and stuff. But those old 70s like kung fu movies are kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of fun just to have on, especially if you just like kind of get stoned and watch them or whatever. They're kind of cool. So just the idea of introducing people who may not be as familiar with them, or giving people the idea of like, oh, you know, I know that this is based on that, so maybe I'll go and seek that out. I love when filmmakers can do that and just kind of introduce a different generation of people to something that they may have missed and they might think is really awesome. And so I love when that happens, and I love telling people like, hey, if you like that, if you like Kill Bill, then go watch these old Shaw Brothers movies, and you'll be like, oh, that's where that's from every time. And it's so much fun to see that, to be like, oh, okay, now I get it, you know. So
who of the divas do we most relate to?
Oh geez.
If we had to take our BuzzFeed, like which diva are you?
I'd like to say Elle or Oren.
Am I really Bud? I don't know.
Sure.
How many times are we taking the BuzzFeed quiz to not be Bud?
Yeah, exactly. just give me Vernita. Gosh darn it. I think I could see myself as what was Vernita? I don't remember. Copperhead.
Yeah.
I think just Copperhead. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like Vernita too. I should have been motherfucking Black Mamba.
I should have been motherfucking Black Mamba. I love it. This one didn't have as many iconic sound cues as the first one.
Yeah.
But you
like
know,
the cartoonish sound cues from the first movie.
Right. But still really fun. There's a great soundtrack, and I mean, yeah, we can't really go wrong with a Quentin Uma like classic.
I mean, like I mentioned before, this is the Quentin Tarantino movie the gays and straight guys can all agree on. Is their love for Kill Bill.
Yeah. We've got a great Mama Slay moment in both of these.
Glad that we finally got to it. Nicholas, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming back on.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on. This was a lot of fun, and we'll definitely got to do it again. I mean, Kill Bill was epic 2 weeks.
Sure. Kind of an unexpected choice that I kind of made this decision as we were mid-moving that we were going to do the Kill Bill episodes.
Yeah. No, but it was great having somebody on to talk to for the second movie, because the first one was just two of us. So thank you again for being part of this. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you again.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll bring you back for Dealer's Choice. Pick something fun and we'll talk about it again. But until then,
I can't wait.
Yeah, we'll see you next time, buddy.
See you later.
And thanks so much, everybody, for listening.
Thanks
Another
so much.
Fun episode. Two-parter. We haven't done a two-parter yet, so this was really cool to bring both of these movies.
Especially fun to revisit Volume 2, because we do not watch Volume 2 a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was really nice to actually sit down and watch it. Give us an excuse to watch it all the way through. And it was nice to let each movie kind of breathe and talk about both of them separately. So that was really fun. And thank you again, Nicholas Romero, for being a guest on this one. That was great convo. But I think right now it is about
Patreon shout-outs.
time.
Let's hear them.
For some Patreon shout outs. So we'd like to give a great big thank you and hello to all of our paid members over on patreon.com/moviesthatmadeusgay, including our friends Anna, Mitchie, Courtney, Christina. Oh, our friends at the How Do You Drew podcast. Andy, Kate, Pep, Tammy, Roberto, Brett, Daisy, Kelly, Chrissy, Steven, Desiree, Laura, Thomas, Lori, Brenna, Jessica Revit, Lawrence, Lisa, Alexis, Thomas, Millie, Ted, Benny, Melanie, Susan, JJ, Shelby, Paul, Jamie, Drew, Genevieve, Dawn, Joshua, Aaron, Nick and Shannon, Christine, and finally Rufino.
Thank you.
You guys, thank you for being patrons.
We have a lot of fun stuff on our Patreon right now. We have our Television That Made Us Gay that we're talking about a TV episode every month.
That's at the $5 level.
That's at the $5 level. Our 90210 episode was really fun.
Yes, indeed.
A really fun opportunity for us to talk about that show, which we have kind of an obscene
A wealth of knowledge
for, which I kind of forgot about until we were on mic talking about it, that we know a lot of fucking about 90210.
Yes,
but yeah, we've done episodes of The Simpsons, Facts of Life, It's a Good Time, and that's at the $5 level. At the $10 level, you'll get the Watch With Us commentaries.
Yes. Those are additional bonus episodes. There's one every month where we sit down and watch a movie, and we record our conversation in real time as the movie's playing. We give you instructions on how to sync up the movie if it's available on streaming, on Netflix or HBO Max or what have you. Or if you're on the DVD, we give you instructions on how to sync it up, play the movie on your TV, play the podcast on your laptop or on your phone, and play the two at the same time, and you'll get a fun commentary track of the movie as it's playing. And there's over 40 of those. And that's at the $10 level. And you can also just listen to them as a bonus episode, but it's really fun when you sync it up with the movie itself. So head over to patreon.com/moviesthatmadeusgay for information on joining and donating. And all of your donations go directly to keeping the podcast up every week and ad-free. Any new equipment or anything like that, all the donations go straight to that. So
you know it is free.
What's that?
Is writing us a review,
yes,
on iTunes or Spotify, and yes, giving us 5 stars.
Indeed, yes, indeed. If you have an iPhone, Apple Podcasts is pre-installed. You can find our show. You can give us a 5-star rating, and you can write a review. It's all for free. It's all already on your phone, and we'll read that review on at the back end of an episode coming up. And if you don't even listen on an Apple podcast, but if you're on Spotify, you can give us a 5-star rating as well. So please do that. That really helps the show get around, and it helps people find us. Don't ask me how, but it really does. You know what else helps for engagement is liking, commenting, reposting, sharing all of our posts on Instagram.
Yeah.
We're at Movies That Made Us Gay on Instagram, and that's where we're most active. So follow us there and interact with all of our posts. That really helps get the word out as well. If you want to follow our personals, feel free. My name is Pete. I'm at Peter Lasagna on Instagram and Twitter.
Scott Youngbowler on Instagram, and follow my letterbox. See what I'm watching.
Yes, indeed. Check out what we're watching. And we watch a lot of new movies in the theaters, all that good stuff. And Scott's rating and reviewing them all, so check them out over on Letterboxd. But until next week, we will see you, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye.